The SAT will soon feature a new score, your adversity index.
So it's really painting a context for the student's background.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about what this means for college admissions. We'll also learn about school-based health centers, talk to some robots with vision, and spend an academic minute preventing someone from hacking into your DNA. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The College Board, the group that produces the SAT, has for several years been testing an adversity index designed to place students' SAT scores in the context of their socioeconomic advantages or disadvantages. This system has been used by about 50 colleges and universities. Last month, the College Board said it would be expanded to about 150 colleges later this year and be made available to all colleges in 2020. Many schools are uncertain about how or if they'll use this index when it becomes available. One of those schools is Pace University in New York. I recently spoke with Marvin Krisloff, the president of Pace, about the index and what it measures.
So the College Board released what they're now calling the Environmental Context Dashboard. And what they seem to be doing is trying to create context for student applicants to colleges and universities. And there are two dimensions. One is a neighborhood measure, looking at things like typical income and family structure and housing. And then the other is focusing on the student's high school and looking again at some of these same socioeconomic factors, housing, income, percentage of families with children in poverty. So it's really painting a context for the student's background, but it doesn't really tell us anything about the individual student other than his or her neighborhood or his or her high school.
So basically, you're going to get a score for what he gets on the test and then a score for the context that he got that test in.
Right. Although what we understand is that this is a pilot and it's only being used by a limited number of schools right now. And it would be an optional measure that schools, colleges, and universities can take into account. So if the colleges and universities, in addition to getting the standardized testing score, wanted to get this other score, this environmental context score, and they work it out with the College Board, they can have access to that.
Is this something that schools have been asking for?
Well, I think that what it does is it helps provide more information about the context. And if you think about, let's say, a big university that receives thousands and thousands of applications, sometimes from places that they don't really know anything about, you can see how this might be valuable information. I do think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I'm interested to see how this pilot goes. And I think there's really no substitute for the individualized, holistic review that places like Pace University and most colleges and universities practice, where we look at the individual person, that person's lives, that person's family, and how that person has performed academically and otherwise.
Do you think there are some colleges and universities this might help more than others, some types of schools?
Well, I can imagine that this might be helpful, particularly to large universities. I do think that admissions offices really do need to do the work to understand individual students, but there are so many students applying to universities throughout the country that this might be an additional piece of information that could be helpful. And I guess I think that more information can be better so long as it's put in perspective. bottom line is colleges and universities are going to focus primarily on academic performance, and for most of us, that is focused on the high school academic record of the student in question.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you know if the students are going to know that score?
It sounds like the College Board has not yet decided whether it's going to be available to the students.
It'd be something that might even try to manipulate it, though I wouldn't know how they would do it. But someone would figure that out, I'm sure.
Well, there might be some honest disagreements about the way the measurements are taken, but presumably they're going to be using census tract. Look, the bottom line about this measure is it's very much a work in progress. The College Board has admitted that. I think most of us involved with colleges and university admissions want to see what happens. But in the meantime, we're going to stay focused on the high school academic achievement, and that's really the number one criterion.
Could this be a preemptive strike before the Supreme Court Harvard decision on affirmative action?
You know, that's very hard to say. I think that in holistic review, you always want to look at the individual factors. Those can be informed by backgrounds, and this is an environmental context, both the neighborhood and the high school. So I don't know, you know, exactly what the College Board had in mind when they did it, but I think that if there's more information that can be accurate and helpful, some colleges and universities may want to take advantage of it.
Well, just how about in your backyard? Is this something down the road that Pace might look at?
You know, we're going to have to see how this develops. We do practice individualized holistic review, and so we really do care about each student's background and want to know about their family, want to know what their circumstances have been, what they've achieved, and if they have overcome odds. So we're going to really focus on the individual student. At some point down the road, this might be helpful to us, but I don't think we're going to take advantage of it for this coming year.
Well, you know, there is something else out there with college admissions that may or may not have something to do with this. The recent scandal where people were arrested for basically paying off colleges and universities to get their kids in. Wealthy people doing that, the so-called Varsity Blues scandal. Do you think this has anything to do with that? Is this the College Board maybe saying, yeah, you know, we're trying to make up for this somehow?
Operation Varsity Blues shows us how privilege and access can be used to pervert the admissions process. It's not the way it should be. And I think what this effort by the College Board is trying to do is to say that people who don't come from wealth and privilege, their background should be considered because they're not going to have the opportunity that some people, and admittedly it's a very small number, had through Operation Varsity Blues. And Varsity Blues is a perversion of the system, but, you know, there certainly are ways in which people of wealth and privilege do have more access. I mean, if nothing else, who can go and visit 20 or 30 colleges? You know, people who have limited incomes, that's very hard for them to do. And the list goes on. So I think that the College Board effort here is an interesting effort to try to provide more information. And of course, it also comes out of a time when there's a lot of criticism of standardized tests as being biased and favoring wealthy people as well. So I think that part of this is probably their effort to try to answer that critique.
Well, with that in mind, there are a lot of schools around the country that are just going test-free now. Maybe this is the College Board saying, really, we have other things to do here.
Well, I do think the College Board is trying to answer some of those criticisms. Test optional has become a significant movement. There are over 1,000 schools, I'm told, that are now test optional. And, you know, what test optional does is it allows students who feel that their test scores don't reflect their academic ability to not present them. I think the vast majority of students still do present their test scores, even at test optional schools. But I think that the College Board is trying to deal with the changing world and the criticism of standardized tests in general.
Marvin Krisloff is the president of Pace University in New York. Reports say the ACT, the other major college admissions exam, has no plans to institute a similar index. A lab at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, is opening the eyes of its robots in a bid to improve humans' quality of life. The best of our knowledge is Jesse King reports.
Pepper.
Yes?
Start demo.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Intelligent Systems Lab. Today we are going to show you a few demos. One of them is Xeno, which can mimic your facial movements, body gestures, and speeches. The other one is me, Pepper. I can guess your age, gender, expressions, and so on. Hope you enjoy the demos today.
That's Pepper, the bright, friendly robot that roams the Intelligence Systems Lab at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Pepper is adorable, with a small smile and gigantic eyes, but it's also the result of years of research into what lab director and professor Chong Ji calls computer vision.
Computer vision is a sub-area of AI, where we're developing computing technology to equip the machine with the perception capabilities. But my specific research area is called human-centered vision. So basically, we want to develop a computer vision technology to understand humans' nonverbal behaviors.
In other words, Pepper not only reacts to audio commands, like Amazon's Alexa, but reads your facial expressions and body language. G envisions a future where machines live side by side with humans, both as research partners and in-home companions for older or disabled residents. But to get there, G says robots need vision to interact more naturally with humans.
I think the machine and the human will coexist. And now we have to, in order for that to happen, we have to build trust between machine and human, right? Otherwise, human always treat machine as a machine, right? So now if the machine can respond in a very similar, natural manner like a human, then gradually there will be a trust.
Zooming around the lab, Pepper's camera and programming allow it to identify the number of people in a room and guess their age, gender, and expressions.
I counted 3 male and 2 female. One person looked angry. One person looked afraid. One person looked sad. 2 people looked neutral. Finish counting.
Michael Lee, a senior at RPI, demonstrates that Pepper is programmed to recognize and find specific people in a room. He says Pepper is happy to perform its estimates one-on-one, but you need to give it common courtesy.
Pepper.
Yes?
Who am I?
You need to look at me if you want to talk.
So it has I give estimation, so if I'm not looking at him as a human, you need to look at other people if you want to talk. So Pepper responds with, you need to look at him.
On a desk across the lab, the small blue robot, Xeno, doesn't have all of Pepper's bells and whistles, but it still takes things a step further. Designed as a companion for children with autism, Xeno mimics the facial expressions of the person in front of it using 5 motors in its cheeks, eyes, eyebrows, and mouth. Xeno can also mimic the most basic body movements, you know, like a boxing stance.
You're going down.
G says there are many applications for computer vision beyond humanoid robots. He figures computer vision can eventually detect diseases or assist drivers.
We can put a camera in the dashboard, monitor the driver behavior, and to see if the driver is focused on driving or not. And we can detect fatigue driving, or we can detect distraction during driving. Right, and we can also warn the driver if, you know, it's dangerous. There's some dangerous behavior.
Using cameras to track their gaze, students in the lab are able to select options from a screen and play whack-a-mole without moving an inch. Of course, the stars of the lab are Pepper and Xeno. G says the physical technology for AI has been around for years, but increased computer power and big data are what's driving the current AI revolution. Lee and G demonstrate Pepper has a limited range of knowledge, for now.
Who is the president?
The 45th president of the United States is Donald John Trump.
So it basically has all this, voice capability, right? Just like the Alexa, Amazon Alexa, right? But here we are focused more vision. So in the future, we're going to combine the two.
Critics have warned about economic impacts and unexpected consequences of AI. So if you're getting vibes of increased automation and robots taking over the world, you're probably not alone. But G says that's a common misconception of AI.
I believe that the purpose of AI is not to replace human. It's more important to augment human, to augment humans' physical capabilities, to augment humans' mental capabilities, and to improve humans' life.
Reporting from Troy, I'm Jesse King.
Still to come, communities around the country are setting up health centers in schools to help students get needed care and treatment. We'll talk about that next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. There are nearly 2,000 school-based health centers around the country. Between 2010 and 2013, the Affordable Care Act appropriated a total of $200 million to support, improve, and expand services at school-based health centers. One state that has embraced the concept is West Virginia. Kelly Caseman is the director of child health for West Virginians for Affordable Healthcare. I caught up with her at the Education Writers Association's national seminar last month in Baltimore, and we talked about school-based health centers.
A school-based health center is pretty self-explanatory. It's a health center that's located either in the school or on school grounds, so kids have close access to healthcare without having to leave the premises of their school.
And in your state of West Virginia, there seems to be more than most states, right?
We do. We have more per capita than any state in the country. So we have nearly 170, which is around 25% of all of our schools are served by a school-based health center.
Why is that in West Virginia? How come?
So many years ago, when the coal industry was booming in our state, we had a lot of black lung clinics. And in the 70s, federally qualified health centers were established, and they morphed into FQHC. So we have a robust network of school-based health centers due to them being sponsored by the FQHCs.
Where does the funding for this come from?
So it's mostly due to billing. So they ensure that kids have insurance once they come in and use the facility, and then they bill the insurance. So that is how they sustain. They have some philanthropic funding for some grant programs, but mostly primary care, mental health care, oral health care is paid for by billing.
How does the relationship with the clinics and the children begin?
So normally when a child starts school, you know how that you get just several pieces of paper the first day that parents have to sign? So there's a parent permission slip to use the school-based health center that the parent has to sign. If the parent doesn't sign it, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't use the center. What often happens is something happens in the school and the child needs health care. So the staff will call the parent and get verbal permission and then take the paper home with them to make sure they get signed documentation.
Does each center just serve the one school?
No. So we have some schools with one on campus. So you may have a middle school and a high school that's in one place, and then you'll have the center in the middle so kids can both kind of navigate in. And then you have campuses that may have elementary school to high school. So they may serve several schools.
Who runs these? Who's working in these clinics?
So most of our school-based health centers are run by federally qualified health centers. We have a couple that are run by acute care hospitals. And most of them are staffed by mid-levels, so nurse practitioners or physician assistants. And of course, they have medical assistants as well as nurses.
And how much are parents involved in this? Can parents actually go to these?
Some can. They differ from center to center. So some school-based health centers actually see the community. They have an outside door where parents can come and go at their leisure. You have some that only see families if there's a particular issue at home, say for example strep throat, and they need to check everyone. So they'll go through the school and then use the facility, and then you have some that just see the kids. It really depends and varies from center to center.
Are you limited as to what can be treated at these centers, or is it just, you know, the whole gamut?
Well, it really depends on what the FQHC or the sponsoring agency can provide, what the school will allow. So one of the more controversial services is reproductive health, and it really depends on the community, what they decide services should be provided within that center. So it's really kind of a community engagement, a community decision as to what services they have.
When a child graduates, what happens then? Is there any kind of counseling? Is, okay, here's how you can get your health care now?
So the hope is if the child stays within the community, they can start using that community health center that's there. So their electronic health record would stay within the community. Our hope by with these school-based health centers is that these kids at the same time learn health literacy. So they take some ownership of their own health care. We know that college students have a tendency to not access health care as needed. They wind up in the ER like others who don't access preventive services. So the hope is that with a robust network of school-based health centers, kids learn how to access health care appropriately. They keep control of their health records, and that when they transition out, when they, you know, fly the nest, so to speak, they can be better consumers of their own health care.
Is there anything unique to West Virginia that you probably wouldn't see maybe in Oregon?
Well, definitely the network of the school-based health centers, the network of FQHCs, the fact that we don't rely on philanthropic billing to sustain our school-based health centers. And I think that a lot of it has to do with we have grassroots support of them. So I think a lot of states have to look from the top down for their support, and we're really from the ground up. So we can really grow and nurture our school-based health centers to, you know, perhaps they start with just providing primary health care. We try to build them up, provide your mental health care, provide your oral health care, and then really kind of cultivate advocates from those centers so we can then inform our legislators about what's happening on that ground level so we can advocate for better policy, better reform, and more services.
Is there much support in the legislature for this?
You know, there is. I would have to say we have a lot of support, but we have that cursory support or peripheral support where they understand what a school-based health center is, but not the complexities of the issues that we're dealing with. You know, the opioid crisis has just created, you know, an epidemic of different needs and crises within the state for our kids. You know, being removed from the home is a very traumatic experience, for example. Starting a new school because you've had to go live with another family member can be very traumatic. So we have very specific needs that perhaps they don't understand yet. And, you know, the bottom line, the cost for all of this is always of much concern. So we have a lot of educating to do.
And what can people not in West Virginia do to get these in their schools?
Well, I think that what they may not know is that they can be advocates for school-based health in their own communities, and it doesn't have to come from a principal, a superintendent. It can really come from the community itself. So go to a Board of Education meeting, say you want to see health care within your school, and then start pushing that momentum within your own community. It can be done. It doesn't have to come from that leadership.
Kelly Caseman is the Director of Child Health for West Virginians for Affordable Health Care. There have been a lot of cybersecurity breaches in the news over the past couple of years, but is something a little more organic than your data at risk? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can someone hack DNA? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jenna Gallegos, postdoctoral researcher in chemical and biological engineering at Colorado State University, discusses cyber biosecurity and the future of the building blocks of our lives.
Biology is becoming increasingly digitized. Scientists rely on computers to analyze data, operate lab equipment, and store genetic information. But these new capabilities also come with new risks, and the threats from these risks are bidirectional. On the one hand, a computer virus could be used to shut down biomanufacturing facilities. On the other hand, software and digital databases could be used to design or reconstruct deadly human pathogens. 20 years ago, genetic engineers could only create new DNA sequences by stitching together naturally occurring DNA molecules. Today, scientists can chemically synthesize DNA using digital sequences as a blueprint. That means you no longer have to have access to physical samples to create a new molecule. Software can be used to design novel DNA sequences, including entire synthetic genomes. The line between DNA and its digital representation is beginning to blur. Digital information, including malware, can be stored and transmitted via DNA. DNA can even be watermarked with encoded links and hidden messages. And not all risks are intentional. Mistakes in translating between a physical DNA molecule and its digital reference are common. These errors could cause costly delays or product recalls. Life scientists today rely on a global supply chain and a network of computers that manipulate DNA in unprecedented ways. We need to start thinking about ways to protect the integrity of the digital DNA world. We need to start thinking about cyber biosecurity.
That was Jenna Gallegos of Colorado State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.